This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. NPR News continues to follow Hurricane Katrina as it moves past New Orleans and up the Mississippi Valley. The storm weakened after making landfall this morning, but remains dangerous. Later this hour, we'll bring you an update from New Orleans and look at preparations underway in communities in Katrina's path. For much of the hour, though, we focus on the reform of juvenile prisons, and as it happens, this story is also set in Louisiana, which was home to one of the most notorious facilities in the country, the Tallulah Correctional Center for Youth. Reports of violence, rape, and brutality at Tallulah prompted lawsuits, and some state officials began to question the effectiveness and purpose of large juvenile prisons. Tallulah, with its 700 beds, closed last year. The state is now moving towards smaller facilities, 70 beds, located closer to kids' hometowns, facilities that look more like dormitories than prisons. The razor wire is gone. There are no more corrections officers in uniform, but newly trained youth care workers. Reforms in Louisiana are still in the process of implementation. There are still big juvenile detention centers open there, but changes are underway, part of a larger effort in many states to reconsider get-tough policies enacted in the 1990s. If you have questions about how this works and why, if you work in the juvenile justice system or if you've been in juvie, give us a call. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is TOTN@NPR.org. And we turn first to Mark Stewart, former director of the Missouri Division of Youth Services. He works now with the Louisiana Office of Youth Development to develop changes in their juvenile reform system. And he joins us from his home office in Jefferson City, Missouri. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Our thoughts and prayers are certainly with Louisiana right now.
Well, that's certainly true. I understand that the changes that Louisiana is putting into effect are based on the Missouri model.
A lot of the components are. During the past year or so, many of the legislators and judges and officials from Louisiana were able to visit Missouri's facilities and were impressed with the low amount of violence, the good success rates of youth not going on to prison, and I think really got the idea. And then Governor Blanco, her staff came in, and we started helping work with them about 6 months ago in reforming the state's juvenile system, and has been very, very active in the last 6 months in making that work.
Well, you've told us a little bit about why they've decided to do it, just to reduce the violence and the recidivism rate.
Yes, that's usually the bottom line. The public wants to know that when these juveniles go in facilities, that they come out better equipped to make it instead of going on to prison. A lot of states around the country have recidivism rates of 60, 70, up to 80% that go on into prison. And in Missouri, that number is less than 10%. But it's you get what you pay for and what you put into a system. And part of the thing is that we're equipping these kids to come out and get jobs and hold them rather than going back into the same patterns of delinquency that they've had most of their life.
What sparked the changes there in Missouri?
Actually, we had a horrible system in Missouri through the 50s and 60s. There was high rates of violence, high recidivism rates. The system was in shambles. There were reform efforts. Very similar to what's happened in other states around the country. We just happened to get a head start on it.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we started doing with is back about 30 years ago, start breaking away from large training schools into smaller, humane, therapeutic treatment centers to help kids and really understand themselves. So instead of punishment, that was put into treatment and rehabilitation. Instead of locking kids up in cells, then we sat and talked with the kids to find out what was going on in their lives. So we've been really, in fact, I was the group leader in the pilot project in 1970, actually 35 years ago. I did the first pilot project, and so we've been working for the past 35 years, moving ahead and making more and more smaller facilities. Now Missouri has over 30 facilities, small facilities located close to kids' homes, and that makes a big difference.
So their parents can come and see them, their families?
Yes, absolutely.
And are they involved in helping these kids as well?
Yes, yeah, very much so. In fact, the families, 99% of the kids go back home with their families. And a lot of times the families have had some problems in terms of how to deal with the youth, their other siblings. So our agency here in Missouri, that the family unit was what we focused on, as well as the youth. Now, some families, when the kids went back, we knew that we didn't get enough stuff in there. But family therapists, working with the families, we have what we call intensive case monitoring, where we hire college students and other folks to go into the homes and work with the kids and their families. It really, we try to surround the kid with a lot of services when they go back out, because that's the toughest time for them with their families, is that first 3 to 6 months when they get back home.
Sure. Size of the facility in and of itself, is that important?
The size is important. Smaller is better. We had at one time in Missouri a reform school for boys of about 600. We had a reform school for girls of 150 to 200. And it was rurally located with the staff were not culturally diverse or racially diverse, anything else. So it was set up for failure. So we found that if you can get a good diverse staff, educated staff, and a staff that is close to the kid's home, and smaller facilities are better. Most of our facilities in Missouri are 20, 30, and 40-bed facilities. We do have a couple facilities that are multi-campuses that hold 70 to 100 kids or so, but still they're broken up in different components. So there's different ways, based on your resources, you have to address the problem.
Normally, communities are generally not too pleased at the prospect of having a prison of any type in their community. Has it been easy to convince places that in the long run they'll be safer with these kinds of facilities?
We had a great deal of success here in Missouri. In fact, a bond issue was passed where the voters approved $20 million to build 200 beds located across the state. And we actually did it in a competitive bid process about what community would give what kind of resources to keep the kids in their area close to home, as well as giving their sons and daughters jobs in the community. So it was not only from the right thing to do for kids, but it was also an economic development package to keep staff and people to give jobs locally at home. So we had a great deal of success in placing these 20, 30, and 40-bed facilities all across the state of Missouri for those reasons.
We're talking about juvenile justice, and if you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is TOTN at NPR.org, and let's get Lawrence on the line. Lawrence is calling from Sacramento in California.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead.
Yes, I had a question about it almost seems as if the deterrent for offending kind of goes away if the child or the offender knows that they're just going to go to just a halfway house or something like that. And I also wanted to ask, what's your reoffender rate? Have you had any kind of surveys or anything like that enacted?
Mark Stewart?
That's an excellent question. In fact, we have a lot of people ask the first part, because there have been the theories, make it as tough as possible so the kids will never, ever want to come back again. And that system is what has failed in this country for many, many years. What we found out was to bring these kids in and find out why they're angry. And they're not treated with kid gloves either. It's tough to go through the treatment to find out abuse issues in your family, drug abuse, alcohol abuse, sexual abuse, all these kind of things. It's not easy to deal with that. So it's not really pampering the kids. It's a tough program that really kids... But we don't need to really lock the kids up and put them in cells where they can't really deal with those issues. So that is the first thought that most people think, is that when they walk in our facilities and the kids aren't locked up in cells and they're not in striped uniforms and they're talking about their inner self and how they feel about themselves and their families. But that's really what makes changes in people. It's not just locking them up, and it's not the fear of being locked up, because in most states they get right back out and get right back in. So the basic question is what? How many do come back into the system? And what we find in Missouri with going through these kinds of programs is that only 8% go into prison after 5 years. So you've got 92% of these kids released from our programs that are not going into prison and making it. So that's probably the highest success rate in the country, because it deals with what got them into trouble, not just kind of hiding it and keeping your mouth shut and your shoes shined. That's not what works with our kids.
Thank you.
Thanks for the phone call, Lawrence. And let's talk now with Mal. Mal calling us from Kansas City.
Yes, I wanted to bring up an issue that is an issue in Missouri, where your expert's from, and also around the nation, and that's how he feels about the use of physical restraint with juvenile offenders, particularly in Missouri, where juvenile offenders are often restrained by their peers. And it seems like a really dangerous practice. We've had over 150 deaths a year. I just wonder how he felt about it.
I'm sorry, how many deaths?
Harvard Risk Analysis Center estimates somewhere between 100 and 150 deaths a year with physical restraint.
Mark Stewart, that sounds awfully high.
Yes, it is. It certainly is. And I think in each system, you have to look and evaluate what's the best way to do with your own system. In many of the facilities where you have larger number of staff and the staff intervene, in fact, that's what we're recommended in Louisiana, is that they do that. In Missouri, we happen to get the culture to the point where all groups, the kids go into groups of 10 to 12 kids. And in that group, you've always got 2 to 3 to 4 kids about ready to go home, another 3 or 4 kids that are very positive and working through the program, and then there will be a couple of new kids. So in those programs, because we only have many times there will be 33 youth and only about 6 staff in the entire facility, have the children intervene and help keep the kids from hurting each other. I've been in many states where they have to call in other staff to break up. Usually what happens is it takes so long that there are children that are killed and hurt in these restraints. We in Missouri, for the past, we've been implementing this system for the past 30 years, and we've never had a serious injury. We've had no suicides. We've not had kids hurt, and that speaks for itself. So, but in a lot of other systems, I would not recommend that, because if you tried the restraints of youth on youth in a system that's very negative or correctional or even in a detention center, that's very difficult to do, and I would not recommend it.
Mal, thanks very much for the phone call. And Mr. Stewart, thank you for your time today.
You're quite welcome. Thank you.
Mark Stewart is executive former executive director of the Missouri Youth Services Institute, he is executive director of the Missouri Youth Services Institute, retired director of the Missouri Division of Youth Services, and he works now as a consultant with the Louisiana Office of Youth Development to develop changes in their juvenile reform system. We're talking about juvenile justice, the Get Tough policy of the 1990s, how they've worked, and newer methods of dealing with young people who committed crimes. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. If you've ever been in the system, if you have a son or daughter who's spent time in juvenile detention, give us a call or email us, TOTN@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're continuing to track the progress of Hurricane Katrina, which slammed into Louisiana early this morning with sustained winds over 140 miles an hour. Katrina's slowly losing steam as it moves north and east. It's now a Category 2 hurricane, but that still means it has very high winds and a lot of rain. Threats of flooding in some areas. More on Katrina later in the hour. Some parents may be happy to hear that a son or daughter who'd committed a crime was treated with a degree of toughness by their state's juvenile justice system. The American public, in fact, seemed to welcome tough love policies in the 1990s put in place by lawmakers in various states. In some of those states, they now report high percentages of youths who've done time often find themselves back in prison as adults. We want to hear from parents whose children have gone through a juvenile rehabilitation program. What worked? What didn't? Would it have helped to get them in a smaller facility closer to home? 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is TOTN@npr.org. Joining us now is Vincent Schiraldi, who once lobbied for juvenile justice changes as director of the Washington, D.C.-based Justice Policy Institute. He's now director of Washington, D.C.'s Department of Youth Rehabilitation Services. He's joined us here in Studio 3A. Nice to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me on.
I wonder, we were talking earlier about Missouri. Did Missouri help set standards for states looking to restructure their juvenile justice systems?
Yeah, everyone is building bit by bit on each other's work. So in the 70s, Massachusetts, and in the 80s, Utah closed all of their big juvenile facilities and went to small units. And then Missouri started doing that right around the early 1980s as well. Mm-hmm. So people have built slowly on it. But for some reason, recently things seem to have taken off, and more folks are looking to Missouri as the most recent and best model out there to emulate.
But there was also a big program during the 1990s to really get tough on kids.
Yeah, there were really kind of two things going on during the 1990s. Some states were going hog wild, locking more kids up, trying them as adults, all of that kind of stuff. And other states were moving towards small facilities. During the 1990s, for example, California reduced the number of kids it had locked up from 10,000 down to 4,000. And juvenile crime went down more in California than adult crime, even though the adults got the legendary three strikes and you're outlaw.
Mm-hmm.
So It's sort of an interesting bifurcated trend.
And interestingly, the trend for juvenile crime nationwide has been down steadily over years.
Absolutely. And it's almost an untold story because, you know, you'll see big headlines when a kid goes out and shoots up a school or steals a car and runs somebody over. I mean, and those are tragic events, and people should pay attention to them. But the story since about 1994 has been juvenile crime down, juvenile homicides down, juveniles behaving better.
Nevertheless, there are still critical issues in the juvenile justice system, and there are critics of the Missouri system, and people critical of what's been going on in Louisiana as well.
Yeah, I mean, we're still largely based on a 19th century model of locking kids up in large, locked, prison-like facilities stuck out in the country somewhere. That's what happened in the 1800s when we actually invented the juvenile justice system, and a lot of states are still stuck there. Part of it is about where their money is. I mean, if your money is already in this big, large, locked facility in a rural environment, it's hard to get the money and the bodies out of there. Mm-hmm. They had a heck of a time in Louisiana closing Tallulah because the local state legislator from that county was lobbying hard to keep it open. It was one of the biggest employers in the region. So these things don't go down easy. They fight back.
There are also corrections officers, unions, and that sort
That's
of thing,
right.
People who don't necessarily welcome change.
That's right. That's right. Bureaucracies don't welcome change in general. It's why the Department of Motor Vehicles usually is an annoying experience for most Americans, and most of us actually go through that. Imagine a Department of Motor Vehicles, but you lived in it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and you begin to get a glimpse of what most juvenile bureaucracies are like.
And they're making your dinner, too. let's get some more listeners on the line. Let's talk to Brian. Brian calling us from San Jose, California.
Hey, how's it going?
All right.
Yeah, I'm 19, and I was in the juvenile justice system here there for like 3 years. For 2 years, I was in an alternative to the California Youth Authority. And for a year, I was in juvenile hall. And one of the things that, like, I don't know, people really get, like, especially in the poor urban areas, like, the biggest thing is, like, people, like, glorifying the fact that they go to prison. Like, I remember one of my roommates was already, he was, like, 17, and he got sentenced to CYA, and he said when he was going to get out, he was going to go to prison. He was going to be one of the top guys in the prison gang and stuff like that. And it's really strange how that happens. And, like, you guys say, like, the get tough thing doesn't really work. Well, for me, like, I was a kid from the burbs, and I got put in there, and so it worked for me. But because, you know, I was around, like, people, you know, like, murderers and rapists and stuff like that. And, you know, it worked for me, but it didn't really work for them. And I think one of the reasons it doesn't work for them is because that's one of the type of environments that they enjoy being in, because it's, you know, it makes them hardcore. It makes them, you know, seem like one of the tough guys.
Now, Vincent Giraldi, is this a problem?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in Brooklyn, and a lot of my friends got locked up when I was a kid, and there were two things were almost always true. One is that they came out worse than when they went in, and the other is that we looked up to them for it. It was nothing improved the street reputation faster than a trip to juvie.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you look at the evidence in Missouri, 8% of the kids coming out of the Missouri system go to adult prison within 3 years. 32%, four times as many, coming out of D.C.'s large locked facility, go to prison within 3 years. That's why the mayor supports us closing it.
Brian, you straight now?
Oh, yeah.
So it did work for you?
Yeah, I mean, it worked for me. And I think one of the main reasons was because of my crime. Like, I was at first going to be tried as an adult.
Mm-hmm.
And then my parents used my, like, college fund to get a lawyer. And, you know, the fact that I could afford a lawyer got me out of that. But I was I was sitting there, I was 16 years old, and I was thinking to myself, you know, I could go to prison for 11 years. I could go to prison with these people. And so, you know, that was the real deterrent for me. I mean, yeah, I went to a place that was, like, kind of like one of the boot camp type places, but they had, like, therapy and stuff. And that stuff, it was nice, but the main deterrent for me was the fact that I was a kid from the burbs being locked up with a bunch of people that, you know, have way different mentality of life than I did.
Mm-hmm. Brian, good luck.
All right, thank you.
Thanks very much. Let's talk now with Robert. Robert is calling us from Oracle, Arizona.
Yes, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to say that they had the scared straight back in the late 80s maybe, and I was a juvenile offender and went into a boys' school slash boys' penitentiary, and I felt like it prepared me to be a future felon, and it prepared me for my future incarceration as an adult.
And did that happen?
Absolutely.
So what you learned in juvie was how to be a better criminal?
Pretty much. How to beat the system and work with the system and hustle the system.
Vincent Chiraldi, this is a criticism that you hear a lot.
Yeah, they're training schools for crime, really, in a sense. I mean, if you think about it and analogize it to schools, my daughter goes to a 3,600-kid school, right?
Mm-hmm.
They all wear dog tags around their neck to say who they are. The principal, there's no way the principal knows any of them. The same is true with these large juvenile facilities. You look at Mark Stewart's facilities in Missouri, and you've got 20, 30 kids in them. The person running that facility knows every kid's name and knows whether little Johnny or little Mary's doing well that day or not. If there was a 600-person school or even a 90-person facility, the person running it doesn't have an individual understanding of what's going on with each one of those kids. And that's why smaller is better.
It is a really bad kid or a really good kid.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. It's just dumb luck at that point.
Robert, I assume you're not calling on the prison phone.
No, I'm not.
All right.
Actually, I'm back in church, and I feel like that's where along with therapy, I feel like I'm a better person and a helpful member of society.
Okay. Robert, thanks very much, and good luck. Vincent Chiraldi, I know you've got to leave, but here in D.C., what is the prospect? You said the mayor wants its large facility closed down?
Yes. We're going to build a continuum of programs for kids in the neighborhoods and then leave some small and rehabilitative locked custody for the kids who are just can't go home, and some kids can't.
And shifting this system, obviously you're talking about the difficulties of it. One of the difficulties is simply what it costs.
But actually putting the kids in the community is typically cheaper. We're spending $500 per kid per day to lock these kids up at the Oak Hill facility we run,
mm-hmm.
and it is bedlam up there. For $500 a kid per day, I can buy an awful lot of services for those kids in their own home neighborhoods.
And Vincent Chiraldi, good luck to you as well. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Vincent Chiraldi, director of the Washington, D.C. Department of Youth Rehabilitation Services, and he joined us here in Studio 3A. While reforms of the juvenile rehabilitation services in Louisiana have generally been welcomed, one organization is calling on the state to better address perceived problems in the system. Joining us now is David Utter. He's executive director of the Juvenile Justice Project of Louisiana. He's with us now by phone from Shreveport, Louisiana, where he's taking refuge from Hurricane Katrina. How are you bearing up?
I'm fine. My staff and I are all safe in other places, and we're all just very anxious to see how our colleagues and families, kids we work with, are doing in New Orleans and, of course, our homes and apartments.
Sure. Getting back to juvenile justice, though, what are your criticisms of Louisiana's reforms?
Well, it's interesting, Neil. It's not so much a criticism as a deep, deep concern. As the other speakers have talked about, the biggest danger to this stuff is getting derailed by politics. And you know, you pointed out, or it was Vinny pointed out, the jobs issue.
Mm-hmm.
In Louisiana, the forces that are fighting reform just have enormous power and influence. There's a $17 million contract that LSU has to provide medical, dental, and mental health care to kids inside the facilities. Now, you know, they're not going to be taking the lead to shut these big, ineffective places down. Likewise, the District Attorneys Association are very committed to that punitive, quote-unquote deterrent model of the razor wire and the, you know, orange jumpsuits. And so Governor Blanco and Simone Gonsalves, the man that runs our system, you know, there's no question as to their commitment to doing the right thing. It's just the very powerful political forces underneath them that we feel like are stifling real reform.
We talked about Tallulah being closed last year. There are two other large juvenile facilities in Louisiana, Swanson, I think, and Jetson. They're going to stay open but be reformed?
Well, you know, that's the big question, isn't it? The state's announced that they want to renovate each of those facilities and make them large multi-use, you know, quote-unquote multi-use facilities. There are a couple problems with that, not the least of which is that they're very old facilities. Swanson's almost 100 years old. And between Swanson, Jetson, and then the third facility, Bridge City, down in New Orleans, you've got about $67 million that it costs to run those places. You know, we supported a bill earlier this year that would have closed Swanson and Jetson in a phase-out, year and a half, you know, slowly moving those kids back into the community with proper supports, and then also capturing the money to build the smaller regional facilities that Missouri has been so successful with.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're just a little concerned about politics taking over sound policy.
David Utter, thanks very much. David Utter is Executive Director of the Juvenile Justice Project of Louisiana and joined us by phone from Shreveport. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. When adults consider proposed reforms of the juvenile justice system, they don't always hear from inside the system. Michael Kroll is senior editor of The Beat Within, a weekly magazine with material written by youth and correction facilities in California. Every week he hosts workshops with kids in facilities across the state. He's with us now from the studios of KQED in San Francisco. Nice to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thanks very much.
What are the main themes you hear from kids about the rehabilitation experience?
Well, you hear two separate kinds of concerns. You hear concerns about what happens to them while they are locked up in these county-run juvenile probation facilities, and those concerns run from specific abusive situations that anyone could predict in any kind of locked institution, to more general young persons. The food is lousy. I have to wear someone else's underwear. I don't have any privacy. I don't have any freedom.
Mm-hmm.
But the other theme, and I think a far more significant theme, is the devastation of their lives prior to ever entering the criminal justice system. It is the path that led them to the criminal justice system that they write a tremendous amount about, which includes abuse, family abandonment, no parents, or at most one parent, drug abuse, guns being prevalent and impossible to escape, and impoverishment to both kinds. By that I mean no money, mm-hmm. and also a kind of impoverishment of spirit, of being connected to a larger picture.
Are these descriptions conscious descriptions of this is what led me here, or is this just a description of what life was like?
Well, both. You'll get both the more conscious. You know, you've got kids locked up from eight in the system in California, in the county systems. I have kids as young as 11 years old and as old as 18 years old, and, of course, run the gamut of abilities. So you get a range of quality and depth of writing. So some young people do specifically see the connection between the lives they really were handed, over which they had no control, mm-hmm. and the path that it forced them on, and others just simply writing, "This is my life." Sometimes very celebratory ways. They like it.
Mm-hmm.
They're excited by it. It turns them on. And that notion that we spoke about before of getting your chops, you know, getting your stripes for going to juvenile hall, going to prison, going to the California Youth Authority, that's very much alive until, of course, the experience is had. And then you get a lot of if only kinds of pieces. I wish I had listened, mm-hmm. or my mama always said, and now I'm living it, that kind of piece.
Do you tend to publish more of the latter than the former?
We publish absolutely everything except those pieces that violate our fairly liberal standards, which is we don't allow certain hate words to be published, although they're very commonly used. We don't allow gang kind of boasting. We certainly allow them to talk about gangs because it's a very common theme, but only if they teach us something, if we can learn something, if they explain something, not if they say my gang is better than your gang and I'm going to show you when I get out.
Mm-hmm.
So other than those limits, we publish everything. And we respond every week to every single piece that we publish. We have a weekly publication that ranges from 60 to 100 pages every week.
And this is read by?
It is read by everyone who writes for it. That is all those young people in the hall. We pass it back out there. And in fact, sometimes we come into conflict with this juvenile justice system, which sees this as a bigger threat in a way than, say, the violence that goes on there. I mean, the system is designed to deal with violence. It can quickly suppress and crush fights, threats, and it is set up to do that. But when you get kind of intelligent descriptions of what's going on and suggestions that this is counterproductive and this might be more productive, then you get a kind of threat to the institution, that bureaucratic threat that Vinnie Schiraldi was talking about. And sometimes it results in, you know, our being asked to leave. And that has happened.
Michael Krall, thanks very much. Good luck.
Thank you very much.
Michael Krall, senior editor of The Beat Within, a weekly magazine with material written by youth in California corrections facilities. He joined us from KQED in San Francisco. When we come back from the break, an update on where Katrina's heading next. The storm has been downgraded, but still packs a mean punch. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.